I am calling to order this first meeting of the House Children and Families Finance and Policy Committee. I'm Representative Dave Pinto, the chair of the committee. Welcome to members. I think that almost everyone in this committee, except for three of us, I believe this would be your first in-person regular committee meeting, either because you're a first term or a second termer. So welcome. So glad to have you. And welcome members of the public who are following along as well. We have handouts for people in the room. There's a few people in the audience. I have to say that I'm really seeing the benefit of virtual hearings also today. There are many who are as well, right? So I'm sure we'll have many more folks joining us in the future in person, but for those watching online, our committee materials are at our committee website, which you can check out. And for those in the room, you're going to find in the folder for members, folks in the audience as well, the handouts should be out there as well, a number of pieces of paper you'll find useful, including the slides for the presentation we're going to see, and also short pieces that talk about some of the issues going to be raised in that presentation and issues that should be of importance to us in our work. And I'll probably refer to those, and I suspect that that our presenter will as well. Committee rules were emailed out yesterday to all House members for review, and then we'll discuss them next week at our committee hearing. I'm going to start, as we always will, by having our clerk, Ms. Kahn, take the role. I should note we have a couple folks I know who are still on their way because of the weather. So, Ms. Kahn, if you can please take the roll.
Chair Pinto?
Present.
Vice Chair Keeler?
Present.
Lee Daniels?
Here.
Representative Bliss?
Here.
Representative Coulter?
Present.
Representative Davis?
Here.
Representative Hansen?
Lee Daniels.
I just wondered, are we live? Can we get the mics on?
It sounded like I can hear myself being amplified. I think yours may or may not be.
It's not working.
Yeah.
Here you go.
Okay.
Sorry.
No problem. Yeah, thank you, Representative Daniels. So please continue, Ms. Kahn.
Representative Hansen. Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
Here.
Representative Hicks?
Here.
Representative Hudson?
Here.
Representative Katiza Watun? Representative Lee?
Present.
Representative Nelson?
Present.
Representative Perez Vega?
Here.
Representative Zalesnikar?
Present.
Okay. And welcome. I believe we have a quorum. Excellent. Thank you, Ms. Kahn. And so what I'd like folks to do to start is we're just going to go around and introduce ourselves, if we can, with your name, the area you represent, and then what may have drawn you to this work. I'm going to ask you to keep it pretty quick if you can. We've got a lot to get through with the presenter, and I will note I'm going to do my very best to get us out of here a few minutes early because I know we have a floor session at 10. To try to make that happen. And I'll talk further, I think, next week about the committee and its work and jurisdiction, et cetera, but I'm just so delighted to be with all of you. I'm going to invite you to please consider sharing the pronouns that you prefer to be referred to by, just as a way of being making people comfortable, feel welcome. If you prefer not to do that, we want to make sure people are comfortable, and so if that makes you uncomfortable to do that, then don't do that. But for those who are able to and willing to, then I invite you to do that. So I'm, again, Dave Pinto. I represent the southwest part of St. Paul, use he, him pronouns, and I have been the chair of the Early Childhood Committee the past two terms and have a passion for this work that stems partly from my work as a prosecutor of domestic violence and sexual exploitation and kind of see how off-path things can get. So I'm so glad to be with you, all of you. I'm going to turn to my vice chair, Representative Keeler, and then Lee Daniels, and then we'll go through other members there. So Representative Keeler, so glad to have you here as vice chair.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Keeler, I represent District 4A, which is Moorhead. This is my second term and also my second in-person committee meeting because we came in COVID, so a lot of our stuff was behind a screen. So I'm really excited to be in person because I do know relationships matter and being able to connect. This work is really important for me. One, I'm a mom, so I know what it's like to have kids in community, and when our early childhood opportunities are slim, that's a disadvantage. But also I was licensed ICWA foster care for many years and had babies in my home and worked in Indian education. So it's just a passion of mine, and I'm excited to be here. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Vice Chair Keeler, and I'm thrilled to have you in that role with me. Lee Daniels, please introduce yourself, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brian Daniels. I represent the Faribault, Janesville, Kenyon, Wanamingo, Nearstrand. My district changed a lot. It went from north-south to east-west, so I'm really loving my new district. I want to get to know everybody. This is my ninth year serving. Dave, Mr. Chair, came in the same year as I did. We were actually roommates on our training for that, so we've known each other since we both started. I got into this thing because I just wanted a voice at the Capitol for my people that I knew in that area. A lot of things that were going on, they didn't agree with, and so my sister, Representative O'Neill, talked me into this in 2014, and I've just loved it ever since.
I'm so glad to have you represent Daniels, and may you all be as lucky in your roommates as I was in mine. Representative Bliss, calling on you.
Thank you. I represent northern Minnesota from Keller to Callaway. That includes both the Leech Lake and White Earth reservations. Starting my third term, this interests me because my wife is a first grade school teacher, 32 years. Her degree is in early childhood education. I see the struggle she runs into, and the kitchen table conversations generally begin with, why can't you guys do something to address this?
Good. We're going to be drawn on that, Representative Bliss. Good stuff. Representative Coulter. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Nathan Coulter. My district is 51B. It's basically the eastern half of the city of Bloomington. Most notably this week, my district includes the corporate headquarters for Toro. So those of you who started your little red snowblowers on the first pole, you're welcome. But I became interested in this work. I actually went to school to be a teacher. And as I got into politics and policy and seeing sort of how important it is to sort of start earlier and earlier and making sure that our youngest Minnesotans are getting just the best possible start they can to succeed beyond that, it became a real passion of mine. And then when I became a parent, it became much more important to me.
Thank you, Representative Coulter. Representative Davis, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ben Davis. I am representing District 6A, which runs from the east side of Brainerd over to Garrison on Mille Lacs Lake there, and then it goes all the way north up to Grand Rapids and Cohasset. And why am I on this committee? I have seven children, so that's probably why I'm on this committee. My wife is the expert when it comes to children and family, though, but she did not get elected. I did. So that's why I'm sitting here, and I'm looking forward to learning and serving with you all. Thank you.
Representative Davis, thank you. Representative Hicks.
Hi, I'm Kim Hicks, she, her pronouns. I represent Rochester, so District 25A, the northern part of Rochester. And I am drawn to this work, I think like many people here, as I'm a parent. I have five children, but I'm a parent of children with disabilities. And so I'm very, very passionate about early childhood support for all kids, but particularly making sure that our littlest Minnesotans who have disabilities have access to the supports and services they need to be successful.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
Thank you. My name is Amanda Hemmingson-Yeager. I use she, her. I represent Southern Maplewood and half of Woodbury, which is District 47A. And I'm on this committee because I'm the mom of two girls. I've always been very passionate about issues involving kids, lots of children and families in my district. And we know that the science shows that most of the brain development happens by the age of three. So I just want to be here to make sure that we're not only supporting kids, but we're supporting the families of those kids. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager. Representative Hudson, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Walter Hudson. I represent District 30A, Northeastern Wright County, so Rockford Township, Hanover, St. Michael, Albertville, and much of Otsego. And I'm drawn to this work, like many have stated, and is a common experience for many Minnesotans because I am a parent, two boys, 13 and 9. And when I think back on my experience growing up and compare and contrast it to the experience that my wife and I have been able to provide for our boys, it's just so apparent how important it is that children have the supports that they need at an early age. And I'm particularly interested in ensuring that parents have their hand on the steering wheel of what happens with their kids as they proceed through that process. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Representative Hudson. Representative Katisa Watun, we'll go to you and then sort of keep the alphabetical order going.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Representative Carly Katisa Watun. I represent Eden Prairie, almost all of the city of Eden Prairie. This is my third term serving on this committee. So I was the vice chair at Early Childhood back in 2019-2020. Served as a member of the Early Childhood Committee last biennium, and I'm thrilled to be a part of Children and Families this year. I also am a parent. This is actually the first election cycle in which my husband and I did not add a child or children to our family, so thrilled about that. but my first year in office, I was the mom of a 2-, 3-, and 4-year-old, so brand new to our family. We are foster parents. We finalized our adoption the day of the special session in 2019. And then we had a surprise COVID baby. So early childhood is my life's work, both home and professionally. And I'm thrilled to be here as a part of the village that raises the children of Minnesota.
Thank you so much, Representative Tease with you. And so glad to have you back to be working with you again. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hello, everyone. My name is Liz Lee. I represent St. Paul's East Side in District 67A. I have a couple reasons for being here. Our district is very young. I said this yesterday in education policy. I don't have any more high schools in my district, but I have a lot of elementary schools, and a lot of those schools are Title I schools. So that also probably means a lot of those kids went through what some folks know as the Head Start program. And so for our youngest constituents, right, early childhood is really important. And also happy to share, I'm a very proud alum of the Head Start program. And I luckily, you know, was also able to go to Yale, where the idea for Head Start and, you know, just the beginning, right, of the study for why we need to invest in early childhood was so important. So I'm excited to share my insights and also advocate for our littlest constituents. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Representative Lee. Representative Nelson, glad to have you here.
Nathan Nelson, I serve from 11B. That's most of Pine County, half of Kennebec County, and two townships in Chisago County. So Rush City, Mora, Hinckley, all the way up to Willow River. I've got basically a school in all of those towns. And but as I'm a father of five, and you know, it's getting the children off to the right start is so important, you know, and talking with, you know, education isn't my expertise area, agriculture is, but in going and talking with superintendents and teachers and, you know, I've learned so much from them of seeing the playing field where they've got parents that have been really involved with their children, have come in so much further ahead in their education path, and you've kind of got to level them out because they're all the same age, and that's how they're kind of grouped through school. And so to be able to help balance that and work that through and make sure that all of our children get a good start is so important.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Representative Nelson. President Perez-Vega, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Maria Isa Perez-Vega. I represent District 65B, which serves St. Paul downtown, west side of St. Paul, a little bit of West 7th, and West St. Paul. I have a background in children and families just by being Puerto Rican. We have strong family ties. We say we're very tribal. I serve as director of mentorship for a nonprofit called the Twin Cities Mobile Jazz Project for over 7 years, where I direct mentorship services for after-school programming and summer school through multicultural arts and music. I am one of those kids that grew up in multicultural arts programming and know the importance of cultural competency in an upbringing of child and how that can reflect in receiving and being educated towards your highest potential and being able to determine what you want to do as a child growing into an adult. I recognize the importance of that and how it can bridge so much and benefit so much to all families in the state of Minnesota. I believe in multicultural arts programming for our children and for our parents, especially when we're living in such a diverse indigenous land of Minnesota. Gracias.
Thanks so much. So glad to have you, Representative Perez-Vega. Representative Zoloznikar, hope I'm saying that correctly.
You are.
Okay.
Thank you.
Please.
Good morning. I'm Representative Zoloznikar. I live in Friedenberg Township, which most of you probably have heard of Hermantown. Our sons graduated from Hermantown High School. I'm interested in this committee. I'm a mom. I've raised two kids. I've worked my entire career. And for the last 30 years, I've been a nursing home administrator. And I've ran 24-hour operations, and I've employed a lot of people who need child care. And I'm very concerned about shift work. Hospitals, police, our core agencies, not having access to quality and accessible and affordable child care. And I hear that all the time when I was door knocking. With that said, I also want intergenerational programming available for children. I grew up with grandparents at the farm. My dad was a middle school principal for public schools and a superintendent. And I saw the value of intergenerational programming. So I've had the value of the knowledge of the wisdom of 103-year-olds my whole life, and I want to be able to share that with children and find pathways for that. And I heard about the need for getting daycare providers, door knocking, in every community. Daycare providers are frustrated. I've looked at the regulations. They're very similar to nursing home regulations, highly regulated. And to have it customized for what parents need. Parents are the anchor. They know what their kids need. And we need to have choices with home-based and corporate-based. And so I look forward to being on the committee.
Thank you so Thank much, you. Representative Lesnikar. Representative Hansen, so we're just introducing ourselves, our communities, and kind of what briefly what drew us to this committee. Please.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. I'm Representative Jess Hansen. I represent District 55A down in Savage in Northwest Burnsville. And I'm a solo mom to two kids. I have one I just put in college and one I just put in middle school. And so this is a really important committee to me because I know firsthand how important it is that we support parents and families and all the things that we need. I've heard about child care and multicultural arts and so many other things since I've been here today. A lot of the work I've done has been around the child welfare system. I passed a bill last year to create an office for youth foster ombudsperson to make sure that we can continue to do work there. And also continuing to make sure our schools are supportive of kids from all backgrounds and families. And I'm just really glad to be here. Thank you, Chair Pinto.
Thank you so much, Representative Hansen. I'll note before having staff introduce themselves that I heard a lot of themes, I think we all did, about supporting parents, supporting families. I think multi-generational programming, I suspect that could be another phrase for what Representative Perez Vega. I think that would be true in the Puerto Rican community, a lot of multi-generational programming.
Right.
So just a lot of good connections there, which is really exciting and a good base for us. I'm going to ask, I'll ask my committee administrator, Coley Colburn, to introduce herself, if we can.
Hi, everyone. I'm Coley Colburn. You've probably seen a lot of my emails. Thank you for all showing up, and I'm glad that it seems to have worked. And I am particularly excited to be working on this committee, especially because of the work that I hope everyone is going to accomplish for our great workers in this industry and in these fields. So thank you.
Thank you so much. And Ms. Khan, committee legislative assistant.
Hi. Hello. Thank you for this is going to be my first session, actually, as a CLA. So I'm definitely learning a lot, and I look forward to learning from all of you guys and seeing all the great work that you do to empower the children and families of Minnesota.
Thank you so much. We're going to go to Molly Peterson, the majority researcher.
Hi. Thank you, Chair Pinto. I'm Molly Peterson. I work in-house DFL research, and I requested this committee so that I could support all of your great work. So thank you.
Thank you so much. And then Jody Withers, the Republican researcher, who I should note I've had the chance to work with in committees that I've chaired for the last bunch of years, and he does a terrific job supporting his caucus and also just the state. So Mr. Withers, please introduce yourself.
Yes, my name is Jody Withers with the House Republican Caucus, working Education and the Children and Families Committees, and I was assigned here to keep an eye on Chair Pinto.
Fair enough. So Ms. Mock, if you could introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Annie Mock. I'm with House Research. I'm a nonpartisan legislative analyst, and I'll be at every committee to answer members' questions and to help with bill drafting.
And let me note, I know a number of people are quite new. We have an amazing House Research and House Fiscal staff. Ms. Mock is one of the researchers who will be working with us. I think in some of the areas of our committee jurisdiction, there will be other people kind of passing through. If you have a doubt as to whom to work with regarding a particular issue, you can connect with Ms. Peterson, Mr. Withers, Ms. Colburn, or Ms. Mock for that matter, figure that out. And then Mr. Berg, if you can introduce yourself, sir.
Hi, I'm Doug Berg. I'm with the House Fiscal Analysis Department. I handle the human services side of this community, which includes all the child care stuff. I'll just note that for the K-12 side, that Solveig Beckel from our department will handle that, and we're also a nonpartisan department that worked for the entire membership of the House.
And so similar comments to members of the House Fiscal Staff. We are so lucky. I can't imagine that there's a state that has a better nonpartisan staff than we have. And so I encourage all members to take advantage of those resources. I know Ms. Beckel got snowed in, was not able to join us. So I'm going to invite, I think we're all set to turn to, kind of looking at the staff here, and I think we're all set to turn to Dr. Subramanian, if he can come on up. Representative Perez Vega, please.
I just got to say, I didn't mention the reason why, Chairman, that this is so important to me. I have a beautiful 3-year-old girl, and she's the purpose of why I'm really in this committee. Gracias.
And having met that 3-year-old girl, I understand that. Representative Perez Vega.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. So as you get settled in, Dr. Subramanian, I'm just going to make a comment to members that, so I've chaired a committee called Early Childhood the last 4 years. This committee has a different name, Children and Families, and has a broader scope, and members have made some comments about the child welfare system. Our committee's work will include those issues and a broader set of issues as well. We'll be able to talk a little more on Tuesday. There's some working out some final details as our committee works out jurisdiction with some of the other committees, Human Services Finance, Human Services Policy, Health Finance, et cetera. If and as you have doubts about that, please reach on out to me, to Ms. Colburn, to the researchers. But ultimately, everything that we do is going to be about getting kids off to a great start. As I say, my focus especially has been the very youngest Minnesotans, but really our focus needs to be on getting all children of all ages off to that great start. So I wanted to start us by having us get grounded by a pediatrician and somebody who I know quite well, a former neighbor, in fact, who's been a leader in this space, to help us to try to think about what is it that kids need to get off to that great start. We know that it is that parental support and family supports, et cetera. How can we think about that from a little bit step-back perspective? So, Dr. Subramanian, I'll ask you to introduce yourself, and then feel free to proceed. As you do, I just want to note again for members that you've got the slides in a handout. Folks watching online, they should be available on our committee website. And then if folks have questions along the way, please indicate either to me or to staff. We likely will stop to ask short questions. We'll try to save some time at the end for longer questions as well. So I think we're all set. Nobody else is stopping me. So Dr. Subramanian, welcome. So glad to have you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Chair Pinto, esteemed representatives, staff, and guests. One of the great thinkers in the space of early childhood recently talked about the topic of gratitude. He said, "I want to let you know the great things that you do." Daniel Tiger goes on to sing, "Thank you for everything you do." Mr. Tiger cannot be here today, nor can Doc McStuffins, nor Professor Blippi or Bluey. But I get to be here, and I get to say thank you. Thank you for thinking about, centering, learning about children. They're a constituency who can't vote for you, who can't donate to you, who make lousy campaign volunteers. And yet you're here thinking about them, and that says a lot about you all. And so my deepest gratitude. My name is Krish Subramanian. I'm a pediatrician at Hennepin Healthcare. I get the privilege of teaching aspiring physicians and pediatricians at the University of Minnesota. I am one of the co-chairs of the Early Childhood Caucus for the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. But in my most important role, I am the father of 3 children, 6, 5, and 1, like many of you all here. As pediatricians and providers, we get the privilege of being present for some amazing moments, some miraculous, some tragic. So this past week over Christmas, I was working in the hospital, and I got to meet a newborn baby. And the truth is that over the next 1,000 days, this baby's brain will develop more rapidly, more profoundly, and more consequentially than at any other time in their lives. The greatest teachers will be the parents, the families, those people who invest their love into this child. The greatest lessons will be the words spoken by a mother, the songs sung by a father, the smiles, the laughs. And then there are the challenging. Whenever I need to be reminded of what love is, I just have to meander into the NICU or the PICU, where you see young ones fighting for their lives. And what you'll see is you'll see parents who have slept on chairs and couches for months on end. I have spoken with a mother this past week who has been at the bedside of a teenager for 2 months. And I said, "I'm sorry that the couches aren't so comfortable." And she said, well, at least I get to be here. Because she knows that sometimes it's that love, those words, that presence that is the healing that medicine can't provide. And we sometimes see the tragic too. And that's when there's no one to do any of the above at the bedside. The common element in all these cases, the joyful, the tragic, is relationships, is love. And I hope to highlight the value of these relationships today, why it's imperative to the development of the early brain and to children more generally that we capacitate these relationships. In today's presentation, I hope to talk about a few things. I hope to talk about the search for early and why. Why does it matter that we think about early? I want to talk a little bit about how the brain is built and why experience matters, why relationships matters. I'll talk briefly about how pediatricians monitor these relationships and this brain development. I want to talk a little bit about adverse childhood experiences, stress, challenges, and how this impacts brain development. And finally, I want to speak about resilience and the capacity we all have to help build resilient children. So I started my career as a teacher. I started as a high school special education math and science teacher. And I loved my job. I taught magical, incredible young people who were passionate and excited. But I also saw ways that early childhood experiences mitigated their learning. Children who had meningitis early on, infections, people who were exposed to fetal alcohol syndrome effects, different things that affected and mitigated learning for the long term. And so while I loved every minute of my job, I also was jealous of my counterparts who taught elementary school. Their ability to teach a child to read by third grade really made a profound impact in their learning as time went on. And so I did a little bit more reading, and I learned about the Matthew effect and the idea that if you can teach a child to read by third grade, they will read for fun, they will read for exercise, they will read more and become more facile at reading and also learn other things more rapidly and well. So I said, okay, maybe I should get into working with third graders. But then research showed me that, no, you actually can start even earlier. So the Cooper et al. In 2018 did a study that showed kindergarten reading scores and kindergarten literacy skills, so letter awareness, phonemic awareness, at kindergarten was actually the most predictive element of deciding how kids would do at fifth grade, both in reading and in math. And this was regardless of their level of social skills. So if you got literacy skills in by kindergarten, you made a difference in everything that they learned by fifth grade. Okay, so kindergarten is important. Then, as I began to learn, kindergarten reading was predictive of fifth grade reading skills. As I learned more, I learned, wait a minute, no, things happen even before that. So this was a time in the early 2000s when Hart and Risley had published their work on the word gap, the 30 million word gap, and the idea that kids in wealthier families got to hear a lot of words, and this correlated with fifth grade reading scores. Now, there's some methodological concerns with the Hart and Risley model, but it's been repeated over the years. And actually, Romeo and company in 2018 showed this data. And they showed that in families who had higher parental education or household income, more words and more conversational turns were heard, so more interactions of language. And then this subsequently led to higher verbal scores later on. So, you know, at this stage of my career, I wasn't sure exactly what was going on, but I knew this. Something was happening between 0 and 5 that capacitated more skills between kindergarten and third grade that then led to greater learning thereafter. It was then that I sort of adventured into medical school and began learning more about why and how this was happening. So we are born with all the brain cells we will ever have, 100 billion brain cells. But the truth is, in isolation, those brain cells don't do anything. They need to be connected. They need to be connected, both sensory, motor. In order to communicate with you today, I need to be able to hear, and that pathway needs to be strong, go up to the brain, and then transmit it back to my mouth and speak with you all. What this means is that connections need to form between brains, and back to high school biology, this forms through synapses. Synapses don't just happen. They need to be practiced. They need to be built. And over the first few years of life, this happens more rapidly than at any other time in life. So you can see here some slides of what brain neuronal connections look like. So for newborns, there's a lot of brain cells, but they just don't have those synaptic connections. As you can see, over the first 2 years of life, and on
Dr.
slide...
Sabrian, yeah, I'm just going to pause. Just want to point out for members who are maybe brand new to hearing rooms, which is true for most of you, that there are also presentations right up in these corners as well that you may be able to... easier to see, because I know the details really matter. So please continue.
Oh, no, thank you, Chair Pinto. If you look at the slide on the right, you can see that up through 6 years, boy, lots of synaptic connections have happened. That's an amazing thing. You can see that compared to a 14-year-old or an adult. It's actually more dense in the school-age children. So it means that these synaptic connections need to be built. But then what happens between 6 years old and 14-year-old and beyond? What happens is we begin to practice. We begin to use certain neuronal pathways and connections, and we use those that are most important to us. So the things that make us do our daily living activities, the things that help us learn. If you are a musician or an athlete, you begin to practice those neuronal connections and those neuronal pathways. And as you can see, it thins out a little bit. But those pathways that stay are the ones that have been practiced over and over again. So the way I like to it's akin to these beautiful temples and churches in Jordan. They're carved out of the stone. The first step we must do is we must build that wall. We must build it up. And that happens in the first 5 to 6 years. Thereafter, we must use experience to build a thing of beauty. And that is through specific experiences. Now, the other thing to think about is that there's a critical time and order to these connections. In utero, lots is happening developmentally. The brain is developing, and my NICU colleagues will talk very, very much about the importance of the in utero environment. You need to support mothers. You need to support babies. And so it begins there. But then in those first few months of life, it is really important that we have an order of connection. We need to first begin with sort of the development of our visual and auditory cortex. We need to stimulate with sound, with visual stimuli. That happens first. Subsequently, we begin to develop the areas of our brain that do with receptive language and speech production. Then subsequently, we go on to higher cognitive thinking levels. You can imagine that for a child who doesn't get the visual stimuli, who doesn't get the auditory stimuli, so let's say they have chronic ear infections and can't hear, it becomes much harder to hear. And then it becomes much harder to learn language. And then it becomes much harder to pick up the skills you're supposed to pick up at Head Start or school or wherever you may be learning the skills. So there is an ordered pattern to all of this. Now, so how to establish a great start? You know, this slide just shows very broadly that there is a genetic biological component. You need the genetic substrate. You need the physical health. You need kids to be healthy. You can imagine the ways that a severe brain infection or a traumatic brain injury could affect brain development. So you need kids to be physically healthy. But after that, it becomes very crucial that we get them the right kinds of experiences. So you see on this slide, they talk about adversity. You want to make sure that there's the right in utero environment, the right supports after a baby is born. So all those environmental factors can affect the expression of genes and brain development. And I want to show you a positive example of how that happens. So this broad equation that we need physical health, including nutrition and the basics, plus developmental experiences, including safety, the loving people, and the interactions, help to lead to a great start. But I want to show this positive example, and this is pretty incredible. So the same team, Romeo et al. In 2018, not only did they track conversational turns that they heard in a household, they also did MRI imaging of the brain to see how the brain responded. And what they found is that those babies who had more conversational turns per hour, who were exposed to more language, actually had more firing, more developed neuronal pathways in a part of the brain called the left inferior frontal gyrus. That's highlighted on this slide. So the more conversational turns that the family had, they actually had more brain activation. They were actually building neuronal connections and brain. So both the environmental consequence of hearing a lot of words, but also the physical aspect of getting more neuronal development led to higher composite language scores. So experience actually built a part of the brain, an incredible thing. Any of us who have tried to learn a language later on in life or learn a musical instrument later on in life knows that it gets harder with time. The ability to change declines with time, and the amount of effort to change goes way, way up. So one of the ways that we can capacitate this and make this happen in the lives of young people is through what we call serve and return interactions. So young children will naturally reach out for interaction through babbling, facial expressions, gestures. You know, we then have a choice. We have a choice to respond and to interact with them or to not. Adults who respond with the same kind of vocalizing gestures going back and forth really is fundamental to the wiring of children's brains. You can imagine it capacitates hearing. It capacitates the action of speaking. But also, as we've seen, it can actually build brain. These foundational pathways are constructed, and it allows everything that we want to come after that to come. So language development, the other skills that we want. I'm going to see if...
Did you understand it, though? Yeah. No.
Okay. I don't think you can hear. Is that right? You cannot hear.
We cannot hear. We'll work on
the audio.
On the technology on that. I might,
Please, yeah.
Maybe as you all work on that, there's a one of the pages in the handouts, members. And again, for folks watching online, if you go to the committee website, you'll see the links to the printout, et cetera, to the handouts. One of them says the science of early childhood development, and it contains a statistic. I don't think that Dr. Shabranian mentioned. I'd like you to just, members, to think to yourself the answer to this question. About how many neural connections are formed every second in a young child? So imagine the number you think in your head. How many neural connections are formed every second in the brain of a young child? The answer is, so again, have that number in your head. The answer is 1 million. A million connections per second in a young child. And so I want to highlight for members the fact that what's happening in these early years is all these connections being formed, and then you cut back, which is why we lose the plasticity of learning, as Dr. Subramanian was describing. So incredibly, incredly important. Do we think we have the...
It turns out we don't have audio, but what you can see here, you can see it through the visual imaging because they're actually both so expressive. This baby is incredibly expressive. They are talking back and forth. And I promise you this baby is not making sense to me, but Dad is pretending like he does. And they are having this great conversation about what they're seeing on the screen in front of them or what they're viewing. And there's a couple things happening here. This child is learning to hear, learning the art of speaking, learning the art of conversation. But maybe most importantly, this baby is learning that when I put something out into the world, there is a loving person there next to me who is going to respond, who's going to interact with me, and that relationship is what allows the child to feel comfortable at age 3, 4, 5 when something bad happens or when something good happens. This is the fundamental of the relationship building.
You will make sure to get this sent out, by the way, members.
It's really cute, and I would recommend it. So the takeaways from this section I just want to point out are that the substrate of the brain is built early. It's built often, as Representative Pinto just pointed out. But the brain requires experiences to build and shape. And that's attentive, loving adults who can make that happen. I'm going to briefly go over how we pediatricians monitor the growth of these relationships and the brain. And I recognize that this is not the health committee, and so I won't dwell on much of that. As we think about what we as pediatricians do, the way I would frame it to any family coming into for an appointment is, we want to see how baby is growing physically. We want to make sure baby is getting the kinds of nutrition and support they need there. We want to think about how baby's developing. Are they doing things that we would expect at this age? Is their brain getting the kind of stimulation we would need? And then we want to think a little bit about safety and the wellness of a family, making sure that the families are okay. This big, crazy slide is all the things we're supposed to do at appointments. Between those elements, physical safety, developmental safety, helping parents out. It's a lot. But if we boil it down to that, it kind of relates to our equation. If we have physically healthy children who are supported with nutrition, et cetera, if we have developmentally stimulated or interacted with children, then a lot of great things can happen. So just very briefly, we do try to ensure the physical health. We do things like newborn blood screening. We do hearing screening. We do pulse oximetry screening and bilirubin screening. We want to make sure that the fundamentals are okay. And then thereafter, we do need to track how babies are growing. Do they have the nutritional substrates they need? Do they have the food that they need? Those are important elements. But then we really take quite a bit of time to think about ensuring developmental and social health. So we think about, at various ages, are kids doing things that we would expect? Do we, and if not, that's okay. But can we help support families to get the kinds of therapies and supports that they need to help their child? Other things that we think about are social determinants of health. Do the people have food, housing, and safety? Because, of course, those are imperative to safe growth. And then one thing that we really think a lot about are parents okay? We know that whether it's maternal, paternal depression or stress in lives can mitigate the kind of interactions that you saw in that video. People can't have those kinds of robust interactions if they're not doing okay themselves. So we need to support parents as well. I showed you this slide, and you can see this in this slide. This is a growth chart. A baby was seen up through about 4 months of age. And then the baby wasn't seen again till about 30 months of age. And you can see that physical growth had fallen off pretty dramatically. This is weight. And in speaking with the child or interacting with the child, you can see, too, that the developmental growth had turned off quite a bit. The child was not doing the things we would expect of a 2.5-year-old. You can see here that with nutritional intervention and other steps, the baby was able to grow, which is pretty remarkable. But unfortunately, a lot of the developmental skills were mitigated, and we weren't able to gain everything back at this time. Now the child will continue to do the kinds of therapies to help them, but it just shows the value of that critical time and that in reality, one of our jobs is to make sure that they have all these elements. Do they have nutrition? Do they have safety, loving people, and the kinds of interactions that would lead to a great start? So this brings up the question of what happens when some of these elements are not present, particularly the sort of social interactions that we would want. many of you may know about this study, but I want to introduce it to you because I think it provides really good exemplification. The Adverse Childhood Experiences Study was originally done between 1995 and 1997 at Kaiser Permanente in Southern California. And it was initially a survey done for 17,000 members of that health maintenance organization. They found it to be actually a relatively affluent community. But what they found through survey work is that many people in this community had had challenging things happen to them as children, as many people in our communities have. They measured the following. These were the adverse childhood experiences originally identified. Areas of abuse, physical, emotional, and sexual, neglect, both physical and emotional, and then household dysfunction largely defined mental illness in parents, incarcerated relatives, substance abuse, domestic violence, and divorce. What they found is that even in this relatively affluent community, ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, were very common. 26% had one, 16% had two. 12.5% of the population of those 17,000 people had four or more adverse childhood experiences. And what they found through their data work is that these ACEs were dose responsive. And by that I mean for every one you get, there were more consequences. And they had lasting effects on health. Things like obesity, diabetes, which are diseases of older people. We don't usually think of heart disease or COPD as having any effect on childhood or a childhood having any effect on them. But what they found is that the more ACEs you had, the more likely you were to have those diseases. They also noted that ACEs had changes in behaviors, whether that was smoking, alcohol use, drug use, and changes in life potential, graduation rates, time from work. And so these were the measured outcomes that they looked at in that 1998 study. As I mentioned, these are things that you don't think of, cancer, COPD, as related to consequences of early childhood. And yet, study after study, the original study and thereafter, has shown this to be true. Whether it's teen sexual behavior, chronic depression, adult alcoholism, liver disease, underlying suicide attempts, the more ACEs people had, they actually were at greater risk for these challenging outcomes. So why is that? Why does that occur? And there's a couple reasons. One, stress and the way it affects our brain. You know, we all know that there's such a good thing as good stress. You know, I'm nervous coming up here speaking to you all. We're nervous driving in challenging weather. It helps, you know, keep us more aware. It helps keep our heart rate up. Keeps us functioning well in stressful situations. However, when chronic stress occurs, when children or adults are facing chronic stresses from all around them, it resets the way our body responds. It means that we don't just get a heart rate up or blood pressure up when the challenging situation comes in front of us. It happens all the time. And that is not good for our bodies. But what researchers have found is that with the more ACEs, we actually see greater challenges within development. So within these neuronal connections that we spoke about, within the brain development, within these relationship buildings, what they found is that children with 6 to 7 ACE score risk factors actually had a 90 to 100% chance of having some developmental delay. If we can think about it on the long-term life scale, if we have a disrupted neurodevelopment, and this changes the way our both social interactions occur, our emotional interactions occur, and cognitive functioning occurs, this leads to higher adoption of health risk behaviors, diseases later in life, and then early death. And one of the key elements, too, that we know is that if people are struggling with disease, early death, challenging health risk behaviors, this affects the way we parent as well. So all those challenges that we have within our own health, within the way we live our lives affects the way I parent. And we see this across the lifespan in this slide on the right, too. So we know that children with more than three ACEs have more challenges with attendance, more challenges with academic failure. Same with high school youth. Our court-involved youth have a far greater rate of having high ACE scores, as do folks with adult adversity, including incarceration and violence. And then, to state the obvious, all that affects the way we parent as well. Now, I want to point out, stress is not trauma, as I said. We will all experience stressful situations. But the difference is, one, how chronic is that stress? How much can we mitigate that stress? But the other key element is, do we have adult caregivers who are protective, nurturing, and loving to help buffer that impact, to help get us through these challenging situations? Resiliency can be built. So these challenges, these stressful situations, do not dictate destiny. Resiliency can be built, but it takes elements and it takes work. Children or adults need at least one stable relationship with a caregiver. They need to help building a sense of self-efficacy and control over challenging situations. And then I think the effect of things like culture, faith, hope, those things cannot be undermined. Those things need to be built and taught and started early. So with some of these elements, you can change potentially stressful situations into less consequential situations. So these are examples of pathways to resilience. And I bring them up because, one, there are a lot of things that you all do for people in your community already. But also, these are the kinds of things that we should be thinking about. How do we capacitate? How do we make these things happen? I heard about the representative's art passion and program. I mean, those are some of the things, music. But for children, it's imperative that we have the things like positive role models, supportive adults, parental involvement, a caring community. And then I think broadly for the community, increasing parent and family infant contact and increasing knowledge of child development. On the more health side, we need to make sure kids have healthy foods and exercise, and then for parents, ensuring that we do help people with mental health and substance abuse and mitigate the impact of those ACEs. This doesn't end at the age of six when neuronal wiring slows down. Our colleagues out at Hopkins, Bethel and her team, they did a study. All right, we've talked about adverse childhood experiences. What about positive childhood experiences? And they looked at teenagers, and they looked at their connectivity with family members. Are you able to talk with family about feelings? Are you understood by them in difficult times? And what they found is that if you have those positive connections, relationships, and experience, there was a significantly lower incidence of mental health challenges. I'll just say that the research shows an impressive ROI, and that's largely due to plasticity, right? The impact we can make at earlier times in life are pretty profound. If you compare the investment in early childhood and preschool program K through 12 interventions compared with later on in life, you get a pretty good ROI. So some of the estimates suggest between $4 and $9 per dollar invested on impact for these little ones. And so the takeaway from this section I would really like to bring up are that challenging situations happen early in life, they're common, and that they add up. They can affect early childhood development. They change patterns of behavior, but also physiology. But they are not destiny. And relationships and learning can help build resiliency. Overall, then, my broad points would be this, that our brain develops early and often. It's shaped by experiences, but it requires attentive adults. These challenges that children experience can add up, but we can build resiliency in them. And so as I think about the questions I ask myself, you know, are we doing things to support new families? And that can be nutrition, that can be resources to be safe and healthy. Are we providing parenting skills, support? Are we supporting and encouraging children in the areas of nutrition and responsive care, consistency of care? I heard a lot about child care. Very, very important. Language development, and then social connections. And then what are we doing? And I ask myself these every day. What are we doing to help combat adverse experiences and build resilience in our families? I realize it's not fair. Today's your first day of session, but I do want to begin with a brief quiz. You can keep your answers to yourself, unless you so choose to share. Who won the 2015 Oscar for Best Actress? Question number two, who was the number one YouTuber of 2021? Question number three, who was the MVP in Major League Baseball in 2016? How about the NFL or the NHL? Question number four, who was a teacher who made a difference in your life? Question number five, what was the name of an adult who made you feel special and loved? I'm not sure about you all, but I don't know the answer to any of the questions, the first three questions. I don't know who won the Oscar. Don't know any of that. But I know that Miss Brummer made a big difference in my life. I know that my parents sacrificed a lot so that I could be here with you today. I think in this world where media and Insta talk seems to consume our young people, it's actually in relationships where we are truly shaped. Every child needs someone who is over the moon about them. We live in a world where not every child has that, but we have the capacity to help build that for children. And so today I hope I gave you a sense of why these relationships are so valuable, and why it's imperative to the health of not only our children, but also our community. I thank you all so much for doing this work, and I'm really grateful to you.
Dr. Subramanian, thank you so much. What a great way to start our work as a committee. Thank you. And I'm so delighted that we do have time for questions. I suspect the folks have some of those, maybe some comments too. I think I'll start with the Vice Chair Keeler. Representative Keeler, please.
Thank you, Chair. This was really good information. My question lies in the fact that we know that 20% of women experience domestic violence during pregnancy. We also know it's the leading cause of death for pregnant women. I know that interaction and conversations in healthy, loving ways stimulates brain and utero. Is there studies that show what that domestic abuse has? And, you know, I've never seen ACEs scores really indicate what happened in utero with the violence. It always starts like after birth and what they have. And so those outcomes have to be different along with generational trauma. And so I'm just wondering what kind of data studies you've done to show the outcome around that and how maybe we are addressing that space. And knowing that when we have pregnant women come in, you know, how are we supporting them in that space, knowing that the outcomes are detrimental?
Dr. Subramanian.
Yeah, thank you so much for the question. And I think, Representative Keeler, one thing that you're pointing out is that ACEs don't begin de novo, right? They don't begin when the child turns zero. They began long before, and I know domestic violence is an ACE, right? Domestic violence is an ACE. I haven't seen specifically about violence that occurs during pregnancy or in utero. I have not seen that data. But we also know that children born in the setting of, whether it's generational violence, children who are born in the setting of challenges to the social determinants of health, whether that's poverty or whether that's having access to safe housing, safe places to live, those have profound long-term effects. So I think that data is all available. And specifically about violence that occurs in utero, I don't know. But I think your question of what are we doing about it, I mean, there are incredible practitioners and programs doing the work of, one, helping and working to ensure that moms are safe and have a safe place. But then I think one of the key elements is, once that baby is born, how is mom, who has now experienced a lot of ACEs, who has experienced trauma, how is mom taken care of from a mental health standpoint, from a physical health standpoint, but also in the patterns. We talk about patterns of parenting and how I transmit my ACEs to my children. How do we teach intergenerational communication, intergenerational care, and how do we support? And I work at Hennepin, so I know about the work there, but I know there are people across the country and state who do it. I tip my hat to my colleagues at the Mother Baby Program at Hennepin who work every day with moms who have experienced either mental health challenges or trauma, and they do heroic work and have saved many lives.
Representative Keeler? Okay. Yeah, you make Representative Keeler's questions. So I work as a prosecutor and have worked a lot in domestic violence, and Dr. Shermany, your response is making me think about part of the driver for me originally running was having looked at looking up the background of somebody who was charged with domestic violence, and I saw in this person's background a child abuse case, and I thought, well, I didn't realize, I wasn't quite sure about that, and then realized that this person was actually the child in that case. And then had grown up in their series of crimes, then leading to this person assaulting his partner. And so trying to break that cycle. I want to note for members and members of the public again, so I pointed out this handout called The Science of Early Childhood Development. There's also one that talks about the impact of early adversity on children's development. These are only two pages, so even legislators can, even we can make it through them. yeah. And also The Science of Resilience is another in the handouts. And then one that talks about how health and learning are deeply interconnected in the body, and so really encourage members to please look at that. Looking to see, are there folks? And then Representative Lee, please. You had a question or comment.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Pinto. Thank you, Doctor. I learned a lot today. I wanted to ask if you had thoughts about the work that our committee could do. These are very unique times. I'm also very interested in the COVID-19 pandemic as an adverse experience for children and for all of us, right? Adults and parents. Parents have maybe lost jobs.
Maybe Representative Leaf, you can just move the microphone to make sure it's in front of your mouth.
Okay. Sorry, I will also. Okay. It's hard to. Okay, here we go. I want to look at you when I address the question. So I'm wondering if we can talk a little bit more about the pandemic as an adverse experience for all of us, whether it's parents losing jobs, unstable housing for the entire family, or also just devastating loss across, specific communities in Minnesota. What should our committee be thinking about in this session and also in years to come, right? Could you also talk about how ACE can be passed between generations and also have lasting effects.
Dr. Shermany.
Yeah, I've thought a lot about this and I've done a little bit of work into thinking about how the pandemic has really affected or how it is an ACE. You highlighted one, Representative Lee, the loss of income and connection with poverty was big, particularly early on in the pandemic. Second, the loss of life and the challenges of that stressful situation in certain families was huge, and I would be happy to send Chair Pinto and the committee a couple studies on that, on specifically on the pandemic. The other thing that I would think about too is we think about brain development and children is what happened. I do think it's really important to think about learning and developmental skills in those first 3 years, and do we have a gap to make up? And I think that's really important for us to think about too, because lots of kids weren't. Whether it wasn't going to school or going to early childhood intervention programs that they may have need. I think particularly for our young people who have special needs and who needed some further OT, PT, or other types of therapies, I think we need to think about how do we support those families. So yes, I think there's that early childhood intervention piece. But then the deep, profound impacts on individual lives, specific families, as well as to the economic situations of a lot of families. So all your work is cut out for you as a committee. There's a lot to unpack there, but yes.
Okay. Any follow-up, Representative Lee? No?
No.
Okay.
Thanks.
Can you, Representative, I'm so sorry about the name. Davis, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative, for bringing up that point about the pandemic. Something that hit me very hard, when she mentioned that was my wife worked in a preschool setting, and they were mandated by the school that they had to keep masks on 3- and 4-year-old children. And some of those children were going home with, you know, marks on their face, trying to keep those masks on them, and some were having reactions to the masks. And my wife would come home sometimes just heartbroken because these children were kicking and screaming and crying that they had to be forced to wear a mask. Mm-hmm. Could that cause an adverse childhood experience, something like that, an experience, in your honest opinion?
Dr. Superman.
Yeah, so I think all of this is predicated on relationships. So I would say that in that situation, a lot depends on what was the relationship like between, you know, child and school. How was it either explained or processed? You know, I don't think every bad thing that happens to a child leads to trauma. I think that's very important. I don't think every challenging thing, for example, we give, you know, whether it's we do a blood draw or a vaccine at times, I don't think that is an adverse childhood experience, even though kids don't like it. The difference is, do you have someone there with you to help explain the process, to explain that things will be okay? In fact, I oftentimes tell parents after a blood draw, it's imperative that you're here to help them process this, because they know that bad things will happen and someone who I love will be there to support me through that process. So I don't think that every... Now, I think there are big questions, and research will tell us about how development is affected through the pandemic. I think that's a really profound question and an important thing, and the studies are going on right now. So we need to learn that. I guess that would be... It's predicated on relationships and how we get kids through it. Now, I don't envy you all. You guys have to make these tough decisions about the public health versus child development, and that's not easy. I get to be biased towards one way. But
yeah, Representative Davis, follow up if you do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Doctor.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, no, I just want to clarify. Mm-hmm. And you know, the poor teachers, you know. And things move so fast, there wasn't proper training on how to deal with it. It's like they're trying to figure it out on the fly as they go. But you're saying, no, that situation cannot cause an adverse childhood effect.
And, you know, obviously the research hasn't been, sir, Representative, the research hasn't been done. I'm sure research
is going on. Is it a possibility that it could be that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea that children would not be happy, yes, I think that is very real. I think that some children weren't excited about maybe their learning environment. I think that's a big deal, and that can undoubtedly mitigate learning for sure.
Thank you, Doctor. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Zeleznikar.
Thank you for being here. I found it very enlightening. I guess my question to you is, the thing that struck me in your presentation, I concur with your suggestion that relationships matter in our development, and it forms earlier than we might think. I'm wondering your thoughts on, we are coming out of a pandemic. We want to mitigate the gaps in learning that we likely have in development, and the part you mentioned on how we need to see smiles, I'm deeply concerned that we haven't seen smiles for 2.5 years in settings of nursing homes. And knowing that you have somebody with you that you love as a breast cancer survivor, when I was in the hospital, I had family with me. And we have many people, mothers and fathers, who couldn't be with people when they were dying and couldn't be with people when they had somebody in a tragic situation in the hospital. And children were affected too. So I'm curious as to how we as a committee best serve people, knowing now that
we are coming out of 2.5 years where we haven't seen smiles. We've been wearing masks, in some settings 24 hours a day. And if that's a connection, a human connection for the brain, that's, to your point, as a professional, critical in our development, how do you suggest we support children now?
Dr. Subramanian.
Yeah, thank you for the question, Representative. Thank you for mentioning smiles. I believe in them deeply, and I value them deeply, and I think one of the things that I hope comes out is that our ability to capacitate relationships and our ability to capacitate those joyful moments that we saw on that video, right? Like, those are imperative. And so, you know, once again, I don't envy all the decisions you all have to make, but I think being, especially right now, aggressively in the favor of capacitating those relationships, I love that. I love that. And I do know how important it is to have family and children. That they need to see our like, they need to have those interactions. So I think that's imperative.
Representative Zlesnikar.
Yeah.
Thank you. Can I ask one follow-up? Yeah,
no, absolutely.
I just wanted to ask, mm-hmm. do you think that the lack of having that connection available to mm-hmm. us in the hospitals mm-hmm. or in childcare or at school settings affected us?
I'm sure for every – oh, so, sorry, Representative Pinto. I'm sorry. I'm sure for every family member it did, right, for every family – you know, and it continues to. For every family member who has someone who can sit by them, I think that's a joyful – thing for every family member who can sit next to either a family member in the hospital or be with their child. I think that's a wonderful thing. So I think circumstances allowing, boy, I would err on the side of those connections.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Representative Lezikar. We've got Representative Hicks up next.
Thank you so much, Chair. I am so excited that you were here today. I just want to say thank you. As a parent of children who have some trauma history, it's always wonderful for me to remember the importance of adverse effects, but also your talk of resiliency and what we can do next. And so I just wanted to say thank you so much as we move forward. I think it's really important to remember that we can't go back and erase what has already happened in any individual's life. I happened to go through breast cancer during the pandemic, and it was not great to sit at chemo by myself. But we can't go back and undo that. But what we can do is work together as a committee and as a body to build that resiliency. And I think you gave us some wonderful suggestions and ideas and fundamental grounding on how we can do that. So just from my heart, thank you so much for today.
Thank you, Representative Dix. Thank you. Representative Perez Vega.
Thank you, Chairman. Just want to express my gratitude and thoughts for your work and dedication to children. I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes as a teenager at 16, and I really want to highlight the advocacy that you showed today on how much music is important in our emotional and social and just cognitive development, right? I got really engaged into learning more about the frequency of the brain for early childhood development back in 2012 when the BCI, which is the Brain and Creativity Institute out of USC, did a study where they showcased the frequency of brain waves from the child who was listening to music while they were inside their mother's womb. And I practiced that when I was in a high-risk pregnancy, thankfully to have my daughter with no complications at birth, and neither I. And also recognizing the growth that with my daughter's development and the youth that I work with as a musician, to feel that eliminating programs with arts and music is like robbing a child's development. So I really like the fact that you showcased and highlighted that in a visual way for folks to see, because I think that's a very strong part and role of why I'm on this committee and why others need to recognize the importance of arts and music in a child's development. So muchas gracias for that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Representative Perez Vega. Music's been a really important part of my life, too, and thank you for highlighting that. Looking to see if there are other questions or comments from folks and not seeing hands. This has been just so helpful, Doctor. I really do want to direct members to the handouts and folks as well, especially as when Representative Hicks was talking, the one about the science of resilience I think is really, really useful. I just want to comment as a setup for next week is thinking about next week and beyond, and for our committee's work, is thinking about, I guess what I've learned from this, Doctor, is that if we want to support kids, we really need to be supporting parents and families and those caregivers, that special relationship, the person who loves that kid. And so we as a committee then, we are in the really good position of having some programs that we are overseeing that can help with that work. And so we'll want to be thinking together about how we can do that. I want to invite members to please be in touch with me, Republican or Democrat, about your priorities, what you have in mind for us to be working together, and making sure that Ms. Colburn or Ms. Conn are not stopping me with anything else that I have. And otherwise, we'll make our way over to session. Doctor, thank you so much. And with that, this meeting is adjourned. Thanks so much, everybody.
Thank you.